After the first snowfall of the season, I invited my boyfriend Lewis to my family's cabin in the mountains. I wanted to have a nice romantic weekend, but at the last minute, Lewis decided to invite our friends Tina and Winston to come too. I liked Tina, and Winston was just fine, so I wasn't too disappointed. We loaded up in my Range Rover, and I drove us to the cabin. Winston and Tina sat in the back seat. They didn't talk much. Robbie slept for a bit, but as we got higher up the mountain, he started making these surprisingly mean-spirited comments about how rich I was. He made it seem like I was this spoiled little rich girl, just because my family had a winter home. When we arrived in front of my cabin, he literally burst out laughing at how huge and fancy the property was.
"Seriously?"
he said. "You own this?" I didn't. My family did. And I barely spent any time here. I was a hard worker who earned all the money I had. I thought Lewis knew that. I brought them inside and gave them a tour of the place. Once again, he kept making judgmental comments. Just because the cabin had an indoor jacuzzi and a massive balcony, he acted like I had everything in life handed to me. Winston politely ignored his comments, and Tina laughed along with him. We ate dinner together and hung out in the jacuzzi. I got angrier and angrier with Lewis and his comments, but I didn't have the confidence to call him out in front of our friends. Eventually, I'd had enough and went to bed. Winston decided to leave with me, but Tina and Lewis stayed behind. I stayed in my room for a bit, but after a couple hours, Lewis was still downstairs. I went down to check on him, and I saw him making out with Tina in the middle of the living room. His hands were all over her. It was like they didn't care if they were caught in the act. I waited at the top of the stairs. Tina pulled away first. "So when are you going to tell her?" Tina asked. I assumed she was talking about me. "After Christmas," he said. "She's probably going to get me a new car." I couldn't hear any more of this. I was furious. I charged back into my bedroom. I'm pretty sure he heard me at that time, because he came upstairs just a few minutes later. He reeked of her. He sat next to me on the mattress and tried to put his arm around me. "What's wrong, baby?" I pulled out of his grasp and walked to the window. The snowstorm was raging outside, making everything pure white. That was when I had an idea. I opened the sliding door to the balcony. "Isn't this beautiful?" I said. Lewis drunkenly stumbled over. "Yeah, babe," he mumbled. And just like I'd wanted, he stepped out onto the snow-covered balcony. That's when I closed the sliding door, trapping him outside. It took his drunken brain a little while to process what I'd done. Then he pounded on the glass door, screaming at me to let him in. "Okay," I told him through the glass door. "As soon as you admit what you were doing with Tina." "What are you talking about?" he asked, his shock and anger sobering him up. "Tina and Winston are asleep right now." I stared him down. "Let me in," he screamed, but I wouldn't. The only way I would open the door was if he admitted to cheating on me. He knew that. I guess his pride was getting in the way. He called me crazy and paranoid. He said that I was lucky to have a guy like him. And still, I just stared into his eyes, waiting. After a few minutes of screaming obscenities and pounding on the glass, Lewis gave up. He sat on the snow-covered balcony like a petulant child. The storm was raging, and snowflakes landed on his hair and shoulders. I felt cold just looking at him. I crawled into my warm bed and fell back asleep. I don't know how long I slept, but eventually I woke up to the sound of Lewis pounding on the glass. "You win," he screamed. "Let me in." I walked to the sliding door and reached for the lock. "Are you sleeping with Tina?"
I asked him. Yes, he mumbled. For months. It was a horrible thing to say, but I had to hear it. I unlocked the door and let him in. He was covered in snow, and his skin altered between bright red and pale white. He could barely walk. I led him to the bed, but he shook his head and walked downstairs. For the rest of the night, he slept inches away from the fireplace. Meanwhile, I slept like a baby in my bed. I didn't feel guilty at all. When I went downstairs in the morning, Lewis was still sleeping in front of the fire. He was lying flat on his back, his expression twisted in pain. Both his hands were discolored and curled into claws. His nose was nearly black. He had serious frostbite. He looked disgusting. I called 911, but the lady said they couldn't send anyone here for hours. The snowstorm had blocked all roads. By then, Tina had already come downstairs. I guess Winston was still sleeping. She ran to Lewis, both curious and horrified. "Baby?" she whimpered, not even hiding her feelings for him. She tried to hold his frostbitten hand, but she jerked back when the contact caused him to moan in pain. Then she turned towards me. "What did you do?" I told her exactly what I'd seen last night, and Tina refused to take any responsibility. She flat out denied that she was even seeing Lewis in the night. She was so horrified by what happened to Lewis that she focused her anger on me. It didn't matter that I'd given him the chance to come back inside whenever he wanted. She glared for a long moment while Lewis moaned on the floor. Then she dove at me, tackled me to the ground right next to Lewis. If she really cared about him, she would have just moved just a little bit to the side before she started clawing at me. Tina and I were the same size, and she easily overpowered me. She pounded her fists into my stomach, so overcome with rage that she didn't even realize that she accidentally pushed Lewis's frostbitten hand into the fire. He couldn't feel the flames spread across his fingers, and we were both too distracted to notice. Soon, the fire had spread to his arm onto his shirt. By then, he could definitely feel it. He started twisting around and didn't have the energy to shake off the flames. Tina quickly pulled away from me as she saw Lewis on fire. She backed away, horrified, while Winston grabbed the carpet and hit him with it until the fire was put out. I guess he'd come downstairs in the middle of the struggle. Tina didn't do much of anything anymore. I think she was too horrified to move. Lewis was still alive by the time the police came, but the damage had already been done. In the end, Lewis got what he wanted. My family paid him $1 million, but it all went to his medical bills.
My name is Micah. I'm a businessman who owns a bunch of real estate, so I'm pretty rich. Last year, my wife divorced me, but because of my amazing lawyers, I was able to keep most of my money and all of my properties during the divorce. Once it was finalized, my twin brother Alex invited me on a ski trip to Park City so we could celebrate my newfound freedom. To my surprise, he insisted on paying for everything. We'd gone on a bunch of trips together in the past, but I always had to foot the bill because I made a significant amount more than he did. He assured me that he could afford it. He'd just gotten a new job and he wanted to spoil me after the divorce. I was genuinely flattered. When we got to the resort, it was so much nicer than any place I'd ever taken him to. This was the top resort in the area. It was founded by some former Olympian, and a bunch of celebrities are known to go there. We didn't see any celebrities, unfortunately, but we saw plenty of snobby rich people. The staff seemed to be walking on eggshells around everyone, probably because there were so many entitled Karens ready to tear them apart if things weren't absolutely perfect. A bellhop brought up our luggage, but Alex acted really mean to him, barely giving him a tip and refusing to say thank you. It was like he was trying to impress me or something. I was so embarrassed that I went downstairs a bit later to apologize to the guy. I'd been rich long enough to know that you should never disrespect the people who serve you. The same thing happened at dinner, and I had to secretly add more money to our waiter's tip to apologize for my brother's rudeness. I was seeing a whole other side to Alex, and I didn't like it. That night, Alex and I were using our room's private jacuzzi when there was a knock on the door. It was a blonde woman that Alex had met earlier in the day. He'd invited her to join us without asking me first. My initial thought was, oh my god, my brother just paid for a But when I looked at her face, she seemed strangely familiar. It might have just been in my head, but I could have sworn I'd seen her before. She joined us in the jacuzzi without introducing herself or even looking me in the eyes. It was a really awkward situation. I turned toward the woman and asked her if she spoke Spanish. She said she didn't. Spanish was our native language, and Alex and I always used it when we wanted to talk about something private. So, I asked him, in Spanish, if this woman was a He laughed. No, she's not. But she is someone special, he said in Spanish. I took that as my cue to leave. I left the jacuzzi and went back into my bedroom. Unfortunately, I could still hear the two of them talking and laughing through the walls. I decided to go into the shared space connecting my suite with Alex's so that I wouldn't have to hear them anymore. And it worked. The walls muffled all the sounds coming from the jacuzzi. I sat on the sofa and texted a couple of people. But then I noticed a paper sitting on Alex's bag. Well, I knew for a fact that it wasn't there before. Curious, I had a look. It was a note written on the resort stationery. It said, "Remember, no witnesses. I know you can do this." It was such a strange message, and I spent forever trying to figure out what it meant. Eventually, it hit me. Alex was here to commit a crime. Someone was paying him to do something illegal. That's the only reason he'd be able to afford a place like this. Was that blonde woman involved somehow? She had to be. I didn't have enough information to go on, so I didn't say anything. I put the note back and I sat by myself, too shocked and confused to do anything else. I could barely sleep that night, my mind whirring. I felt deeply paranoid. The next morning, Alex woke me up as if nothing had happened. I guessed my suspicions had calmed down over the night. That note could have meant 1,000 different things. Alex and I got changed, had a quick breakfast, and then rode the ski slopes up to the top of the mountain. I asked him about that woman he was with, but he dodged the question. I'd only skied once before, so I followed Alex's lead. Most of the skiers were gathered around one side of the mountain, but Alex took me to another spot with no other people. He pointed to a sign with two black diamonds on it, explaining that this was the beginner slope. I looked down, and it didn't look beginner level at all. It looked terrifying. I asked him why we didn't go to the other side where everyone else was. He smiled and said, "Because I have a job to do." Then he pushed me. I slid backwards off the ledge. I was able to spin around, but I couldn't stop. I was careening down the mountainside. It was the single scariest moment of my life. I narrowly missed trees and rocks, but that was purely because of luck. Pretty quickly, my luck ran out and my body slammed against the side of a tree. I felt my arm snap. I landed sideways on the snow, pain shooting through my body. It was snowing again, and I was too banged up to stand. I looked around, but there were no signs of anyone else. I screamed for help, but my voice got lost in the wind. And that's when I remembered where I'd seen that blonde woman before. It was my ex-wife's sister. It had to be. She must have had some work done, and she'd probably taken Ozempic or something, because she looked so much thinner than the last time I'd seen her. But it was her. I knew it. Just as I was losing hope, I heard a rumble cut through the raging wind. A snowmobile was driving right toward me. It stopped a few feet away and a man jumped off. I immediately recognized him. He was the worker who had helped us with our luggage, the man that Alex had disrespected when we'd first arrived. "I saw what your brother did to you," he said as he helped me to my feet and guided me to the snowmobile. He took me straight to the medical office where a doctor examined me and put a splint on my arm. I had a pretty major cut on my forehead, too, so he patched that up. He wanted me to stay there and rest, but I needed to see my brother. I ignored his warnings and rushed back to the main lodge. Alex and my former sister-in-law were sitting together in front of the fire, drinking champagne and congratulating themselves on a job well done. As I listened in on the conversation, I was finally able to piece together their plan. They had been working together to kill me, knowing that Alex would inherit all of the money I'd kept from the divorce. Then they'd split the profits. The only problem with their plan was that I wasn't dead. Once I got all the information I needed, I walked in as if nothing had happened and I sat between them on the couch. "What's up?" I asked casually. Eventually, the police came and arrested them both. They also arrested my ex-wife, who had helped orchestrate everything from the beginning. I'm safe now, and my arm's all healed up, but I don't think I'll ever be able to trust anyone again.
Last winter, I made the biggest mistake of my life. I decided to stay in the dorms over our Christmas break. My parents were expecting me to come back for the holidays, but I was a freshman in college, and this was my first time away from home. I had so much fun during the semester that I didn't want it to end. So, I told my parents I wasn't coming. I expected a lot of parties in the dorms with the other students who chose to stay behind. Unfortunately, I didn't realize that literally everyone I knew would be gone. On my floor, only me and Creepy Carl decided to stay in the dorms. Creepy Carl lived a few rooms over, and he genuinely unnerved me. It was impossible to have a normal conversation with him because he'd always change topics to something morbid. I tried extremely hard to avoid him throughout the semester, and now I was stuck with him. On the first night of vacation, I was in my room when I heard someone walking and giggling in the hallway. It was creepy, high-pitched, some type of giggle that didn't sound like Creepy Carl. I assumed that meant that another student had stayed behind. I rushed to my door when I looked into the hallway, and it was completely empty. The giggling had stopped. Just to make sure, I knocked on all the doors to see if this giggling girl had entered one of the rooms. No one had answered until I got to Carl's room. It took him a few seconds to answer, and when he did, he was rubbing his eyes as if he'd just woken up. "Did you hear anyone giggling?" I asked. His eyes got wide, and all the sleeplessness disappeared from his eyes. He told me never to mention it again. And if I ever heard giggling again, I had to stay in my room, no matter what. I asked him why, but all he would say was, "Stay away from the giggler," like it was some urban legend or something. Then he closed the door on me. I tried to forget about the whole thing. The next day, I walked across campus to grab some food from the supermarket. No one else was around. On my way back, I was crossing the snow-covered courtyard when I heard it again. The giggling was coming from behind the trees. It sounded exactly the same as last night. I was going to check it out, but Carl's warning replayed in my head. I rushed back to the dorms, forcing myself not to look over my shoulders as the giggling faded into the distance. I stayed in my room for the rest of the day, trying to convince myself that I was just imagining things. I called my family just to hear their voices, but I admit that I was alone and scared. I lied to them, pretending that I was having a blast with my friends. So when I got off the phone, I felt even lonelier than I had before. I played music from my computer just to drown out the giggling if it happened again. I worked because I didn't want to hear anything outside the door. Just after sunset, someone pounded on my door. I was going to ignore it again until I heard Creepy Carl's voice. He begged me to let him inside. I did. He was panicked and out of breath. He said that he heard the giggling too. It was right outside his window. He said that we had to watch each other's back for the rest of the break. Once again, I asked him to tell me everything he knew, and he slowly explained what he'd heard about the giggler. He said that every winter, at least one student went missing after getting too close to the mysterious woman who had haunted our campus. He said that it was a ghost of some sorority girl who had died decades ago, and the only way to protect ourselves was to ignore her. He made me swear that if I ever heard her outside my window, I needed to cover my ears until she went away. I will, I promised him. I knew the story sounded ridiculous, but his expression seemed so serious. Plus, I heard the giggling myself, so I couldn't deny it. Creepy Carl left pretty soon after that. Late that night, Carl's warning was proven correct. I heard the giggling right outside my window. We were way up on the fifth floor, so there was no way that anyone could have climbed up there. It had to be a ghost. I knew I shouldn't have looked, but curiosity got the best of me. I followed the sound into my living room area, where a dark silhouette with long hair was lurking right outside my window. Even though I couldn't see her face, I could feel her staring directly at me. And of course, I could hear her horrible giggling. She was swaying her head from side to side. I almost ran into the hallway to warn Carl, but something forced me to stop. It was like I was magnetically drawn to her. I slowly walked back to the window, my feet moving on their own. There was an umbrella leaning against the wall, and even though I couldn't stop myself from moving closer, I was able to grab the umbrella. The ghost woman stopped giggling. She whispered, "Open the window," in her horrible voice, and I did. No matter how much I wanted to run and hide, I felt compelled to do what she asked. I opened the window, still not able to see her face, though she was inches away from me. I took that umbrella and jabbed it at her, just once, but pushed it as hard as I could. The figure instantly toppled backwards and fell all the way down to the concrete. I leaned out the window and saw her lying motionless on the ground, her long black hair covering her face. This didn't seem right. A real ghost wouldn't fall like that. I raced out of my dorm and knocked on Creepy Carl's door. He didn't answer. Alone and scared, I took the elevator down to the ground floor and walked outside to see if this ghost girl was still there. She was. I saw her stretched across the ground, blood spreading out under her. I didn't want to get any closer, but I needed to see her face. I crouched next to her and pushed aside her long black hair. It was a wig. As soon as I saw her face, I started to hyperventilate. This wasn't a ghost at all. This was Creepy Carl in a wig and a black dress. There was a rope next to him, probably what he used to climb over my window from his own room. This whole time, Creepy Carl was pranking me. There was never a giggler. And now, Carl is dead.
I jolted awake, drenched in sweat, the remnants of the dream still clinging to my consciousness. The dream about Dora felt so real, so vivid, that I couldn't shake the feeling of her, her arms wrapped around me. My partner, Jake, slept soundly beside me, oblivious to the turmoil raging inside my head. I glanced at the clock. It was 6 a.m., Another day at the small supermarket awaited me, but this day felt different. The supermarket was a small, tight-knit community where everyone knew each other's business. On most days, three or four of us worked together, but last weekend was different. A coworker had called in sick, leaving just Dora and me to run the place. Dora and I always had a good rapport, but it had never crossed into anything remotely flirtatious. She was going through a messy breakup, and I was happily settled in my relationship with Jake. As I got ready for work, the dream replayed in my mind like a broken record. I tried to shake it off, but the feelings lingered. When I arrived at the supermarket, Dora was already there, her usual cheerful self. I couldn't help but feel a pang of guilt as I looked at her, wondering why my subconscious had conjured up such an intimate encounter. The morning passed in a blur of stocking shelves and helping customers, but I couldn't escape my thoughts. Dora noticed my distraction. "Hey, you okay?" she asked, concern etched on her face. "Yeah, just didn't sleep well," I replied, forcing a smile. She nodded, accepting my answer, and we went about our tasks. But the dream kept creeping back, and with it, a strange, unwelcome attraction to Dora. I felt like a terrible person. Jake was everything I could ever want in a partner, yet here I was, fantasizing about someone else. As the day wore on, I found myself stealing glances at Dora. Her laugh, her smile, the way she tucked her hair behind her ear, all of it seemed more alluring than before. I knew I shouldn't feel this way, and I certainly didn't want to act on it, but the dream had planted a seed that I couldn't seem to uproot. That night, I went to bed early, hoping to escape my thoughts and sleep. But the dream returned, even more vivid than before. This time, Dora's touch felt electric, her glance burning into my skin. When I woke up, I was filled with a confusing mix of guilt and desire. Jake was still asleep, his arm draped over me protectively. I loved him, and I didn't want to hurt him, but my feelings for Dora were growing stronger by the day. The next morning, Dora and I were scheduled to work together again. My heart raced as I approached the store, my mind a whirl of conflicting emotions. When I walked in, Dora greeted me with her usual bright smile, and I felt a pang of guilt so intense it nearly doubled me over. We worked in relative silence, the air between us charged with an unspoken tension. I could feel her eyes on me, and it made my skin prickle with awareness. As we stocked the shelves in the back room, the tension became unbearable. Dora finally broke the silence. "Is everything okay? You seem really off lately." I took a deep breath, knowing I had to address the elephant in the room. "I've just had a lot on my mind," I admitted, avoiding her gaze. "What kind of stuff?" she pressed gently. I hesitated, and then decided to take a leap of faith. "I had a dream about you," I confessed, "and it's been messing with my head." Dora's eyes widened, but she didn't look away. "What kind of dream?" A romantic one," I said, my voice barely above a whisper. "And now I can't stop thinking about it." For a moment, Dora was silent. Then she stepped closer, her expression softening. "Dreams are weird like that," she said. "They make you question things you'd never thought you'd question." Her proximity made my heart race, and before I knew what I was doing, I leaned in. It was a hesitant, tentative show of affection, but it ignited something deep within me. We pulled away, breathless and shocked by what we had just done. "I'm sorry," I said, stepping back. I shouldn't have done that."
"It's okay,"
Dora replied, her voice shaking slightly.
"But maybe we should talk about this."
We sat down in the break room, the atmosphere heavy with unspoken words. I told her about my feelings for Jake and how much I loved him. Dora listened, her expression thoughtful.
"I've been feeling pretty lost since my breakup," she admitted, "and I think I was looking for comfort in the wrong place."
We agreed to keep things professional and focus on our respective lives. I went home that night feeling a strange mix of relief and sadness. I knew I had to come clean to Jake about what had happened, but I wasn't sure how to do it. When I walked in the door, Jake was waiting for me, his expression concerned. "You've been really distant lately. Is everything okay?" I took a deep breath
and sat down beside him. "I need to tell you something," I began, my heart pounding. "I've been having these dreams about Dora, and today, we kissed." Jake's face fell, and my heart broke at the sight. "Why didn't you tell me sooner?" he asked, his voice trembling. "I didn't want to hurt you," I said, tears welling up in my eyes. "I love you so much, and I don't want to lose you." Jake was silent for a long time, processing what I had said. Finally, he spoke. "I appreciate your honesty," he said quietly, "but this is a lot to take in." We spent the rest of the night talking, trying to make sense of our feelings. It was a difficult conversation, filled with tears and moments of silence, but it was necessary. In the end, we decided to work through it together. I promised to be more open about my feelings, and Jake promised to support me no matter what. The next few days at the supermarket were tense. Dora and I avoided being alone together, and I tried to focus on my work and my relationship with Jake. But the dreams continued, growing more intense and disturbing. Each night, Dora and I were closer, the encounters more passionate, and a shadowy figure loomed in the background, watching us. One night, the dream took a darker turn. The figure stepped into the light, revealing a twisted version of Jake, his eyes burning with a sinister glow. I jolted awake, my heart pounding, unable to shake the feeling of impending doom. At work, Dora sensed my anxiety. "Something's wrong," she said. "You're even more on edge than before." I hesitated, but decided to tell her about the dreams, including the latest one. Her face paled. "I've been having dreams too," she confessed. "About you and me and Jake." A chill ran down my spine. "What do you mean?" She looked around, making sure no one else was listening. "In my dreams, Jake is always there, watching us. And it feels real." We decided to confront Jake together. That night, I told him about Dora's dreams. His expression was unreadable, but he agreed to meet Dora and me at the supermarket after hours to discuss it. The store was eerily quiet when we arrived. We gathered in the break room, the air thick with tension. As we started talking, a strange feeling washed over me, a sense of being watched. I glanced at Jake and I saw the same fear reflected in his eyes. Suddenly, the lights flickered and a cold wind blew through the room. The temperature dropped and an oppressive darkness seemed to envelop us. The door slammed shut and we were plunged into darkness. Panic set in. We tried to leave, but the door wouldn't budge. The room felt like it was closing in on us. I heard a whisper, a voice that sounded like Jake's, but twisted and malevolent. "You can't escape," the voice hissed. "You belong to me now." A force pushed us together and the temperature dropped further. We huddled close, seeking warmth and comfort. The voice continued, taunting us with our deepest fears and desires. "Give in to your desires," it whispered. "Only then will you be free." In the darkness, our fear and confusion morphed into a desperate need for connection. I reached out for Jake and Dora, and they did the same. Our touches were hesitant at first, but the overwhelming presence of the entity left us no choice. We sought solace in each other, our touches becoming more urgent, more desperate. In that moment of terror, we gave in. The room seemed to pulse with energy, the oppressive force feeding off our emotions. Our bodies moved together, driven by a primal instinct to survive. As we reached the peak of our frantic encounter, the darkness lifted and the oppressive presence vanished. The door flew open and we collapsed in a heap, exhausted and trembling. We lay there in stunned silence, the reality of what had just happened sinking in. The break room was bathed in eerie, flickering light, but the malevolent force was gone. "We need to get out of here," Jake said, his voice shaking. We gathered our things and left the supermarket, the experience leaving a haunting mark on our souls. In the aftermath, we struggled to process what had happened. We knew we had been manipulated by something beyond our understanding. The dream stopped, but the memory of that night lingered. Jake, Dora, and I were forever changed, bound by a terrifying experience that forced us to confront our deepest desires and fears. We vowed never to speak of it again, but the bond we formed in that moment of darkness was something we could never forget.
My name is Jason, and I'm an Uber driver. I make good money, and I've never really had any issues with difficult customers, except for one night. It was about 11 on a Saturday, and I had to pick up a couple outside of some bar in the center of the city. They seemed pretty normal at the time. The boyfriend had his arm around the girlfriend and was whispering something into her ear. She nodded gravely. I assume he said something like, "Our ride is here." They got into the back seat, and I caught a good glimpse at them. They were both maybe in their 20s, all dressed up for a night out on the town. I guess it was a little strange that they were going back home so early in the night. I said, "Hey, Janie, right?" That was the name of the person who ordered the ride. The woman didn't respond until her boyfriend elbowed her in the side. She said, "Yeah, Parkland Street." She seemed like she was in some kind of daze. She didn't seem upset or anything, just quiet and numb. I started driving. We rode in silence for a little bit, and then I noticed that the boyfriend was whispering in her ear again. He kept telling her something, and she didn't move or respond. This lasted for a few minutes until she finally snapped, and she muttered, "Please stop." I watched them in the rearview mirror, and I could see that the man was holding tightly to the woman's wrists. Her body was angling away from him. She seemed extremely uncomfortable. As an Uber driver, I only engaged in conversation with my customers if they asked me questions first. Over the years, I've realized that some people want to chat, and some just want to ride in silence. Normally, I wouldn't have said anything to these two, but I couldn't help myself. I really had a bad feeling, and I wasn't sure why. "Is everything okay?" I asked. "Yeah, why?" the man snapped at me. The woman looked up at me. I could see her eyes in the mirror, and they were looking desperate. She was pleading with me. I honestly had no idea what to do. Nothing inappropriate had happened, but I couldn't shake the feeling that this woman was in trouble. "Miss," I said, "are you okay?" "She's fine," the man shouted. I could see that he was squeezing her wrist. "Aren't you, babe?" "I'm fine," she mumbled. I didn't know what else to say. I just kept driving. After a few more minutes, we pulled up to their house. It was on a dark, quiet street just outside the city. There were a few other houses nearby, but it felt really secluded. As soon as I parked, the man pushed his door open and jumped out. "Come on," he shouted at the woman. She didn't move. "Ma'am, do you want me to take you somewhere else?" I asked her. She opened her mouth to say something, but then her boyfriend grabbed her and started pulling her out of the car. I knew I should have done something, but honestly, I was scared by the whole thing. On one hand, I could have just been a couple fighting. It happens all the time. On the other hand, I felt like she might have been in real danger. And if I tried to do something, would that just make things worse? The man pulled her out of the car, slammed the door shut, and took her to the house. I felt terrible for not intervening, but I just sat in my car and waited. My phone buzzed, notifying me that a tip had gone through. I saw that it was for $9.11. 911. Was that a message? Was she trying to ask me for help? She could have written something, but she didn't. Maybe her boyfriend was watching her phone, and she couldn't write anything else without him noticing. I knew then and there that I just couldn't leave without doing something. I was about to call the police when I heard a scream come from the house. My blood ran cold. If that woman was in danger, I couldn't wait for the police to arrive. I had to do something right away. I jumped out of my car and raced across the front yard. Instead of going to the front door, I ducked under the window and looked inside. There was a curtain blocking my view, so all I could see was their silhouettes. I could hear the woman begging for her life. "Please," she said. "You have to let me go." I could see their silhouettes struggling with each other through the curtain. The larger figure, the man, dove at the smaller figure and tackled her to the ground. Something fell with her because I heard a shattering sound. I couldn't wait any longer. I ran to the front door, ready to break it open, but it was already unlocked. In seconds, I was inside, and you won't believe what I saw. The man was lying dead on the floor, covered in his own blood. Right next to him were shards from a fallen vase, and the woman was standing over him, holding a blood-covered piece of vase. She'd been able to stab him while he was attacking her. She killed him. "Ma'am, are you okay?" I asked. Without saying anything, she stepped over his body and handed me the piece of vase, the murder weapon. Then she pulled out her phone and called 911. Good for her. Her face was completely blank, but the words that came out of her mouth were hysterical and horrified. "Please, officer," she said. "You have to help me. My Uber driver just barged into my house and killed my boyfriend. Please come." I looked down at the weapon, now covered in my own fingerprints. What the hell was this woman trying to do? Clearly, she killed her boyfriend in self-defense. Why would she pin this on me? When she ended the call, she looked at me and smiled. "I'm sorry. I had to do it. The cops are on their way." "I don't understand," I said. "He deserved what he got," she said. "And I can't go to jail for this. And you're just an Uber driver. What do you have to live for?" I wasn't scared, because I knew she wouldn't attack me. She needed me to take the blame for her boyfriend's death. When the police came, Janie completely broke down, pumping out fake tears and explaining that I had charged inside and attacked them for no reason. They were about to arrest me, but thankfully my car was parked right outside the window, so my dash cam picked up everything that happened. They questioned me for about an hour and then released me. I'm not sure what happened to Janie, but I can tell you in all my years of Uber driving, I've never had quite that strange of an experience.